It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
We live in an age of contradictions, the ease of life at home and the cost of war abroad. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The daily ease with which we move through the world, the first world that is, tends to hide the harshness beyond our own immediacy. Jane Satterfield has explored those contradictions in her poetry in Apocalypse Mix, winner of the Autumn House Poetry Prize, and she's received numerous awards for her work. And since April is National Poetry Month, we have her in our studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So before we actually get into the meat of things, I ran across, I think it's a quote, says, "Why I don't write nature poems." Tell me a little bit about why that is. And what is it that attracts you about the kind of thing that you are writing about?
That's a great question. The poem that's titled "Why I Don't Write Nature Poems" was written at the Virginia Center for Creative Arts, which is a wonderful artist colony. And when I arrived, a fiction writer said to me, like, "Oh, I guess you're going to be one of those poets who writes about the cows that are in the fields." And I said, "Actually, no, I don't write nature poems." So the first thing that you do as a poet to say that you don't do something then becomes exactly what you do. And after I wrote the poem about not writing nature poems, I began to be very interested in exploring the non-human world.
Okay. So turning to the book that we just referenced, tell me a little bit about the theme that you seem to be exploring. There's a lot of images on the one hand, as I indicate, sort of the ease of life here at home, but then conflict in particular seems to then come back into your poems.
That's a good question. My dad was in the Air Force when I was young, and then he became a reservist. So we lived in near Andrews Air Force Base when I was young and later in Frederick, Maryland. And so I think the sense of military culture and the presence of war was always a sort of background to my life. And I was struck by the contrast between the way that there are soldiers who give their lives for our freedoms and our way of life, and they're asked to take tremendous sacrifices. They leave families, their families make sacrifices, but then sometimes wars go on, and the populace at large is kind of blind to them, and sometimes blind to the effects. But at the same time, the experience of war and the language of war, like, resonates beyond the battlefield. And so often we use metaphors of war when we're just talking about everyday experiences, like dealing with our colleagues or dealing with our family members. So I wanted to look at the way that we kind of turn a blind eye to some of those conflicts.
Do you find that to be especially true these days? I mean, the United States is actually, well, involved, at least in one war, was involved in two over the years, went on. Some of what people have said is that because we have an all-volunteer army, a very small percentage actually goes and fights, as opposed to, say, for instance, Vietnam, where you had the draft, which pulled lots of people in. What do you make of that moment in time that we're now living through, where we have this contrast?
That was very much a part of what was behind Apocalypse Mix, because when I was, you know, raising my daughter, one of the things at schools, we were often asked to bring in, you know, chocolate bars or bring in, you know, like a towelettes or things that could be sent overseas, and the students would write cheerful messages. And it was somehow it seemed as though we did our job in recognizing what they were doing. So for me, I wanted to start to pay attention a little bit more.
So you make reference, I think, to the Great War. I think it's a bestiary for a centenary. I hope I pronounced
that right.
Absolutely. In it, you talk about what are innocent creatures, amongst other things. Pigeons, for instance, no one recruited them as with posters or trips abroad, obligations to protect honor or the golden opportunity to earn as as you learn. Why did you decide to pick particularly some of those animals who obviously are participating in a war that they know nothing about.
Well, it was interesting. There was a feature in the Atlantic, I believe in, I think, 2016, that was a photo essay about the animals in World War One, and I don't think I had ever until that point seen the extent of how technologically the First World War was very different from other wars. And so the idea that, you know, dogs might be running out and laying and helping people lay telegraph wire lines, the idea that pigeons were relied on for messaging, which is fascinating to think about in the culture of instant messaging, right? And the way that our systems of communication are different. But I felt that the more I began to look at the images of the animals and to learn more about how animals were put into service as beasts of burden and more, it sort of became a way of looking at the economy of war and the way in which war is an industry, and to start to ask questions about who profits from that industry.
I was going to remind you that there was a film a few years back called War Horse.
Right, absolutely.
In which you see a horse who goes through a series of individuals who die during the war itself. I mean,
yeah. And one thing that was the other day, I had the opportunity to visit a class that Adam Tavel, another Salisbury poet, is teaching at Warwick Community College, and there was three veterans in his class, and they were they wanted to talk about that poem because it really resonated for them, the idea of people being sent to war without really having power to make decisions. They found it very moving, which was rewarding for me to hear.
Now, the other thing, by the way, towards the end of the poem, I think you talk about that which is left behind. You talk about in farmlands, forests, and cratered ground, munitions and bones of missing men keep turning up. And that was actually struck me because I remember going to Germany and taking, I guess it's the Autobahn, down through into Belgium, and looking off to the side, and there was an off ramp for the Ardennes forest, which of course was the major highway, as it were, of forest where the Germans during the Second World War funneled through. And I remember thinking to myself that the forest has now been reduced to an off ramp.
Right, and certainly the effect of battle and all the shelling did destroy farmlands, and there are, I think, as I mentioned in the poem, some towns were wiped off the map, never to exist again, just because of the sheer destruction of the shelling. And I think it's important for us to remember. It's a very powerful warning.
And also struck by the idea that as we see conflicts around the globe, war leaves its aftermath in the forms of things like mines and so on, and even the kids suffer.
Absolutely. So I think it's important to think about the soldier's perspective, but certainly the effects on civilians are equally destructive. And certainly the toxic legacy of shells and munitions that are buried in the ground, that's a issue, I think, for people to think about.
You also have another poem, Radio Clash.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about the inspiration for this.
That was a poem that I was asked to contribute a poem to an anthology called London Calling, which was a celebration of the 40th anniversary of the Clash's album, London Calling. And it was put together by two poets, Jerry LaFemina and Greg Wilhelm. And so I said, okay, well, what's my memory of the Clash? And I wanted to write about the experience of being in the grocery store and hearing sort of the Clash's kind of like background music compared to music that was very alive and very new when I was a young person.
So, and in it, you seem to indicate that this music is an attempt in some fashion, or at least sort of to keep at bay the images that you create when you talk about war. I mean, I think there's a couple of lines where you said, what couldn't punk do if not make things burn a little brighter? Beat back images burned on a brain pan's strafe of jets against the sky, foliate walls of flame and families bunkered down. There was like this, as if the music were keeping away that reality.
I think,
or did I interpret it right?
I think that I would say, well, for me, the music of The Clash was some of the really inspirational in terms of the way they took on issues and questions of social justice. And certainly one thing that was fascinating about punk music, it was about truth telling. And I kind of latched on to that, I think. It's something that's very important to me as a poet. When I was younger, I was struck by the work of Wilfred Owen, who's a very powerful voice in telling like it is about war. And I found that same kind of impulse in The Clash. And so it was important for me to kind of think through those issues in the poem. So the music is a kind of like resistance in some ways, a kind of celebration of life and an articulation that in some ways there are aspects of life that we're not told the truth about, but we must find the words to tell the truth and break the silence, I guess.
Do you think that art, whether it's music or it's poetry, is doing that today?
I think it is. One thing that's fascinating is there's so many young people who are interested in poetry and also very interested in spoken word poetry, and that idea of being able to open up a door, not just in terms of their own self-expression, but to share experiences and stories about experiences that have been sometimes worthy of celebration and sometimes things that you're calling people out on.
The other thing, too, is as you indicate in another poem with a baby carriage and so on, incident in which you seem to be talking about the shape, how war and conflict shape us here at home. And it's particularly, I don't know whether it's necessary that it was too specific to London in particular, or but you give the sense that how war changes us and maybe separates us.
Yeah, so Triptych is a little bit of a time travel poem. I saw a photograph of protesters in London outside of the British Embassy, and I couldn't help but thinking of the day that I visited the embassy to get a passport for my daughter. She was born in England, and so she's both a British citizen and an American citizen, and so to fill out the paperwork for that, we were at the embassy, and I was kind of thinking about how much had changed over the course of the 20 or so years since I visited, and I had an encounter, just a very brief encounter, with a Muslim woman who did not speak English very well, but she came up and approached me and was sort of admiring my daughter and, you know, rubbing her hand along her face, just in this, you know, sort of woman to woman embrace of the beauty of life and the joy in having children. And it was a very powerful memory that stuck with me for many years. And it wasn't until I saw that photograph that I was able to access the energy for the poem.
So do you think, how does war then divide us, do you think?
I think war divides, sometimes very literally, by putting boundaries up. There's places that we can't travel to or we don't go, and I think it creates emotional divisions between people, and certainly the poem Triptych. When we're engaged in wars, we are literally taking sides, and so we begin to sort of dehumanize people and you know, break the world down into us and them, which is a very destructive way of thinking that breaks down our humanity and ability to work together for the common good.
And you asked this question about how to speak of what we share, what separates us. If there's a woman in the crowd, I don't see her.
Right.
What are you asking for there?
So in that photograph, it was a group of male protesters, and I was just trying to imagine, how had that woman who I had that brief encounter with, how had her life transformed in ways? Today, would I be able to have that kind of exchange, or would the sort of backdrop of war and the fear that we have of others, the sort of sense that someone might be a terrorist, that is troublesome, would that stop people from communicating with each other?
You also have a slightly different thing, but perhaps connected, which is Crossing the Shenandoah in Late Summer. Tell me about that poem and the contrast, or the question that I think that you're asking.
In that's another poem where I'm asking about the divisions and the ways in which we define people in terms of groups. And it's a poem that looks at the legacy of racism in Maryland. That was a poem, I think it was probably the first time I saw outside of a history book, a Confederate flag. And so the poems, you know, looking at what it was like to be a young person and say, why is this there? What does this mean? What am I learning about the world?
So when you saw it, what was your impression? Did you think much about it at the moment?
At the moment, I just wondered, you know, usually you see, I had seen up until that point, I was a teenager, images of the Confederate flag in a textbook in the context of a discussion, history lesson, let's say, about the Civil War. So the idea that it was sort of material for a bumper sticker that might, or a flag that might be flown in someone's car as a emblem of identity, was a little bit puzzling to me.
You write it, and you said, I guess you asked a question about pride and heritage and liberty, you ask, or am I staring at an open secret? What do you mean by that?
Right. And I think what I mean is that sometimes we often turn away from our history, the history that's underfoot. We turn away from the legacy of our country. Sometimes we look at the moments that are certainly worth celebrating, that we should be proud of, and sometimes we sweep things under the rug. And I think that poem is, I'm trying to think about that subject.
So what do you, given that poem and that observation, what do you make about events then today?
Well, in Baltimore, we had several, Baltimore is a very divided city. And so it is, I think most poets feel like it's our responsibility in some way to think about how do we break down those divisions and how do we come to terms with the legacy of slavery and the legacy of injustices that society can perpetuate.
What do you make of the political dialogue that we're seeing that seems much sharper than I think it's been in quite some time? But
yes, sharper than I think I would remember in my lifetime. And I remember growing up reading, learning about Watergate through the cartoons. It seems like a very different time. But that inability, I think, to be civil, to look from at different points of view, to kind of speak to one another as individuals. And one of the things that's very powerful that poetry can do is poetry is sort of the repository of our stories. And so it allows us to hear multiple voices. So I say read more poetry.
as a solution, right?
Right, right.
Or do you think we are listening to one another or do you think we're not?
I think there's pockets where people are. I was at my neighborhood block party. We have a block party maybe sometimes twice a year, sometimes once a year. And, you know, one of my neighbors said to me, now, it's an election year. Don't talk politics over there and over there and over there. They're not on our side. You know, so there we are with that metaphor of war, our side, their side. And so it was refreshing that we just took politics off the table. And so I think when people can do that, there are times when political discussions are necessary, but I think there's times when we should take them off the table and that we might try to listen to each other. It's very hard. It's easy to talk and hard to listen.
Do you think there's an underlying emotional division and resentments that we're seeing that just simply coming to the fore?
That most, I think, social scientists.
Always been there, yeah.
I teach I work with faculty on the Peace and Justice minor and curriculum at Loyola, and so some of my colleagues in social sciences would definitely say that that's the case. But I think that I think there's moments where people are more open. For example, there's a great deal. Women are coming forward. Telling their stories. Survivors are coming forward and telling their stories about sexual harassment. And it's important that we create the spaces for people to be able to tell their stories and for others to listen. Because I think that dialogue of telling stories and listening to each other becomes a way that we can start to move toward action.
Do you think part of the problem is that we have difficulty in coming to grips as a nation with the kinds of changes that we're seeing? Obviously, there's the demographic change, but there's also cultural changes as well. That creates this friction between various groups of people.
Well, there's so much that's changing so fast. There's also the pace of technology. Which puts news in people's faces 24 hours a day with a kind of intensity that is not the equivalent of seeing a newspaper dropped on your doorstep, right? So everything's so fast-paced. I think people become revved up by sound bites that are played over and over, and certainly Twitter sort of is like stirring the pot in some ways, although Twitter has. So the technology has this wonderful power to connect people, but also a power to divide people. So I think that's one thing that we're facing. And then there's certainly things, like you mentioned, demographic changes and generational changes. And there is also, I think there's climate change too. Like, we're seeing tremendous storms and we don't quite know what are the forces behind it? Things are happening so rapidly. I think it makes people nervous and want to hold on to the way things have always been, in a kind of like wave of nostalgia. I think it's a human impulse not to fear change.
Speaking of climate change, you going to write about it at all? Or have you written about it already?
I'm writing a little bit about it in the book that I'm working on right now. Just began writing about sort of the non-human perspective in my local neighborhood. And then I think inevitably that leads you to look at the changes that you see both in your small area and your state, and then to begin to look larger.
Yeah, because I mean, Ryan, in fact, I just finished reading it. I said The Uninhabitable Earth, I think, has just come out, which talks about all this various scenarios and things that are going on. And it seems, I was reminded of a song that was written actually back in the early 1960s about what was then the existential crisis, which was nuclear war.
Right.
Now it looks as if it's climate change. And unlike that, which back in the 1960s could be controlled, perhaps this is not so much.
Right. And it's hard for us to, and reports keep coming out that the pace is accelerating, or that it's bigger than we might understood or have measured. So I think that does create a sense of anxiety. I know when I've talked to students about the things that they fear the most, many of my students will say climate change, because they're looking, we're sort of on our way out, which
really
is one of the most difficult things about being human, right?
Right.
But thinking about the legacy that we leave to younger generations, and they're sort of asking that. They're sort of asking questions, are we the last generation? And that's a very painful question, I think, for young people to ask. And certainly, having grown up in an era where the threat of nuclear war was very near, I think students are also feeling that again. One of Tara Elliott's students at Salisbury Middle School, just sort of when they were writing a post-apocalyptic postcard, one of the students said, I'm terrified of war and nuclear war. And that was a comment that I don't think I've heard young people bringing up since maybe, I don't know, like maybe the late 80s.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So that definitely is a little bit in the air, sadly. So more poetry.
More poetry. Finally, I want to end talking about, and returning to war, special screening, which, well, tell me a little bit about what you were doing here. I guess it's based in part on screening of the Black Hawk Down.
So I had the good fortune for a number of years. Mark Bowden was a writer in residence at Loyola, and he was in my department, so I could sort of walk by his door, say hello. And he was teaching journalism. And so when that book came out, we had the opportunity to have a private screening. And I was able to take my dad, which was a big deal for him, because he had read the book and was admired the work that Bowden had done to talk about how that particular mission went wrong and some of the challenges that those on the ground face. So it was a very moving experience for my dad to go through the line, shake the reporter's hand. And I wanted to write about that poem, but it was interesting because I was sort of taking it in as a literary event. And my dad was sitting next to me, sort of finding all the little faults in the movie in terms of like what technical things in terms of the gear, like that wasn't the, you know, exact kind of, you know, boots that people wore at that particular moment,
because
he had been called up as a reservist during the era of Desert Storm. So that, you know, the military paraphernalia and so on were very clear to him, and I wouldn't have noticed that. So I had my personal like fact checker with me, and it was just a very, very sort of sweet moment, I think, where I was able to sort of take my dad to some part of my life that also was a window on his world.
And you mentioned that after it's over, I guess, some of us still stockpile Cipro. We toast a season of good cheer and a new year.
Right.
As if, okay, now we go on with it. Even though there are Blackhawks down, as it were, going on, even as we speak, say, for instance, in a place like Afghanistan.
Right. And that moment, of course, it's shortly after 9/11. And so there's a great deal of fear at that particular moment about what would unfold. And things unfolded in ways that are very different than we imagined. Like we feared, I think there was a smallpox. The anthrax, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
And so people were sort of stockpiling Cipro as a way to deal with the fear of bioterrorism. But we had other things to deal with. And certainly I've invited veteran writer Dario Di Battista to speak to my students a few times. He's edited an anthology called Retire the Colors, which is about the experiences of men and women who have fought in Afghanistan and Iraq. And students find it very moving because they often feel very cut off from the military. There's a divide between, I think, civilian culture and military culture, sometimes for good reasons, other times because it's too painful to connect with people who are undergoing experiences that are so traumatic and profound on our behalf. I think it's hard for the average person to kind of connect.
I know, Samantha, we did a story, I think it was last year, about a couple of veterans who had tours both in Iraq and Afghanistan, right. And they both suffered from the post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
And things like they said when they came home, one of them said that they didn't like going through doors.
Right, absolutely. And there's a number of poets, terrific poets who are vets. Brian Turner is one who's wonderful. In his book, I think, came out in 2005 called Phantom Noise, and it's about the experience of PTSD. There's another wonderful poet, Seth Brady Tucker, who was in the first Gulf War, and he has a terrific sets of stories and books. So it's a boon from the experience of war is that it's a boon to literature in some ways. So many people are writing beautifully about the experiences of war and the ways in which it transforms both individual and national consciousness.
In fact, one of the things that struck me, particularly looking at, for instance, the aftermath of the First World War II, is that there are people who come to grips with and write about these experiences and have oftentimes an impact on the social side in which they live.
I think that's what we hope that poems will do. We'll have some, they'll resonate with readers, but they'll also sort of spark in some ways social change.
Well, we've been speaking with Jane Satterfield. She has her book, Apocalypse Mix, which is a winner of the Autumn House Poetry Prize. Obviously, lots of other awards, which you don't need to mention, I guess.
Thank you.
And Synthesis Discourse is the April National Poetry Month. And we wanted to at least get you in and chat about some of the work that you've been doing.
Oh, it's fabulous. National Poetry Month is always a terrific celebration of poetry. And we have our national poet, Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith, who's really a terrific poet and really sort of energizing the poetry world. And I guess locally we're going to have Salisbury will have its first Poet Laureate, which will be announced this week. So that's very exciting, too.
That's right.
Spread the good poetry gospel.
Well, again, we've been speaking with Jane Satterfield. Appreciate you stopping by and chatting with
us. Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. Many students anticipate their turn at some corporate position, but others are looking in another direction. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. There's a world of nonprofit work ranging from the Red Cross to advocacy groups in Washington, D.C. They're known as non-governmental organizations, which do what the private sector may not have incentives to do. And there are efforts on college campuses across the nation to expose students to this field of endeavor. In our studio this morning is Carolina Baum. She's the Salisbury University Campus Director, the Nonprofit Leadership Alliance. Catherine Jackson, SU's Program Specialist for Interdisciplinary Studies. And Ben Paraboom, who is a student at SU and has been involved with the program. Carolina, what is the Nonprofit Leadership Alliance?
The Nonprofit Leadership Alliance is a program, a national program, where there are about 42 universities who are partnering with students from all over the country and preparing students to be nonprofit professionals, people who know how nonprofits work.
So tell me, flesh that out a little bit more about what kind of nonprofits are we talking about? What's the history of this program?
The history of the program, it's long. It's 70 years old. We just celebrated the 70th anniversary. And there are all sorts of nonprofits, some big ones like the Boy Scouts, Habitat for Humanity, the YMCA, but also small ones, local ones that are doing a lot of good work for their communities.
What's the history of this? I mean, how did it get started?
Well, it got started because there was an interest in bettering the communities, and we wanted people to be well prepared because we may have the desire to improve the community, to help the people who are underprivileged or people who need education or other services, but we need to know how to do it. And organizations that are serving those communities also need to be financially responsible. They need to offer good programs. They have to follow a code of ethics. So that's why we have that organization that is providing guidance to all nonprofits.
So, by the way, how did you get involved?
How did I get involved? I was always interested in nonprofits. And actually, I did a little bit of work in a nonprofit in Ecuador, South America. And then I was here at the university. I've been here for a long time working as a Spanish professor. And I have a background on leadership and nonprofits. And I was asked to lead this program. And that was 2 years ago. And it's the best thing that could have happened.
So you mentioned, by the way, that what nonprofit did you work in?
In Ecuador?
It
was an educational nonprofit. I was in the marketing and PR department. And now it's a very solid organization in Ecuador. And actually, I was there last week. And I made contacts with another nonprofit, Hearts of Gold, that's serving nonprofits that serve people in rural communities. So I'll start also collaborating with them.
So what was it like, or what's your experience like in terms of developing a nonprofit? I mean, what are the problems that you have to overcome? What are the kinds of things you have to keep in mind?
Well, one misunderstanding is people think that in nonprofits, people cannot make money. And there are jobs, there are job positions. But of course, it's not a place to become rich, because the nonprofits have a mission. So along with fulfilling that mission is obviously maintaining a good budget. And that's one of the misconceptions, that maybe nonprofits run with no money, but we do run with money. And nonprofits apply for grants, but also do a lot of fundraising and also reach out to donors who are interested in seeing their communities better in some ways.
How is it, do you think, different in terms of doing this in a developing country? I mean, obviously you've got a government, which is obviously different than ours, but also you have extremes, rich and poor, and so on.
You're right. It is different. So, you know, the United States is the country where there are more nonprofits in the world. People are very generous in this country. Also, it goes back to the time that the country had the Industrial Revolution, and a lot of people became rich. We know names like Rockefeller, Carnegie, and others, and they started donating to institutions. In countries in Latin America, nonprofits are not so big. Also, because culturally, families take care of those who are in need, even extended family. So it's also the idea that you have to help your own first. But in the United States, we are fortunate to have people who really don't need to know the people they are helping, and they are collaborating and funding programs that may not directly affect them, but affect their communities.
So Catherine, tell us a little bit of, A, how you got involved with this. Maybe, I don't know, maybe perhaps drafted, I'm not sure. But nonetheless, and what you see as the benefits of a program like this?
I don't know if drafted is the right word. Maybe I was voluntold.
I like that.
Carolina, there's every year the Nonprofit Leadership Alliance holds an Alliance Management Institute.
Hold on. Let's stop for a second. For this microphone, you're right, Dawn. This is not acting right. I'm getting the same thing that you had the other day.
Right.
No. It's okay. I just need to...
make sure everything's all sort
yeah,
of
yeah, I'm sorry about that. I don't That's mean to okay. mess you all up.
Shoot, we had a real good start.
I know. I don't mean to mess you up. Here.
You want to try? Have her say something?
Yeah, just chatting
that
again.
And I like to. That's good. That's a good bit. Good bit.
So, Catherine, so what did you have for breakfast this morning?
A bowl of Cheerios. That's what I had, and coffee.
Okay, what does that sound like? Is that any better?
I don't know what is going on with that one.
How about you use the other one over here?
Okay, that's fine.
Let's use the other one over here. Yeah, he's going to swing
it
around.
Yeah, I am so sorry.
That's okay. I'll just put myself.
Yeah, you can just go. Yeah, just slip over there.
Yeah. Oh. It's
a nice
thing about not being on TV.
That's
right.
Do whatever we want.
not in real time.
And it's not live. Right. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Chat to that one for a second.
So what do you have for breakfast? Cheerios, right?
A bowl of Cheerios, yeah.
That's much better.
Okay, that sounds good.
Okay.
Okay, so we'll pick it up. So I've asked you... So how did you get involved with this, and what kind of things do you see that are involved with putting this program together?
Carolina was unable to go to the annual conference. Every year, the Nonprofit Leadership Alliance holds an annual conference, their Alliance Management Institute. Carolina was unable to go, and so I was sort of voluntold that I they needed my presence there, and of course I didn't object. It's this year it was being held in Orlando, Florida, in January, from January 2nd to 4th, and so it was a great opportunity to travel and to learn more about the Nonprofit Leadership Alliance, and to learn more about the students who are enrolled in our certificate program here at SU. And I went with 11 students from Salisbury University, and the students have to go to this AMI, the Alliance Management Institute. It's one of the requirements for their leadership certificate. And so we had 11 students, and it was a wonderful trip, and I do not regret in any way having been voluntold.
What was that like?
Oh, it was wonderful. First of all, it was wonderful because the students our students in this certificate program at SU are awesome. They are interesting. They're exciting. They're on top of at the top of their game. They are engaged in their community around them and want to see their communities become better. And so I think one of the things that motivated these students to become involved in the certificate program in the first place is because they want to see people succeed in their communities. And so we were able to go, and there were presentations and workshops and networking opportunities with other students and universities and nonprofits from around the country. And our students did a great job, and it was exciting to learn about them. But there were also opportunities for me to become involved in the Leadership Alliance itself. And I had a chance to judge some student presentations during an ideas forum. And during this forum, students from the universities that are part of this Leadership Alliance made presentations. They brought their presentations with them. They presented on research that they had done. They presented on internship opportunities that they had created. They presented on their student leadership associations about in their own universities. And so I had a chance to sit and listen to these student presentations and hear from these young people around the country at the various universities present on their student associations and the things that they're doing. And
what kind of things did you hear them doing? What kind of areas are they talking about? Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, there's a process issue here, but
right,
what kinds
right.
of things were they interested in doing?
Well, they were presenting on how to fundraise. And how they were learning how to fundraise and how to fundraise well, and how to work through the process of fundraising. And so that experience is one that they can then translate into their work world when they graduate and become employed at a nonprofit. As Carolina said, nonprofits are always fundraising. And so being able to have that experience in their college career is then they can learn a lot of that the hands-on skills that they need. Other students were presenting about opportunities that they created to volunteer in their communities and how they had created these opportunities and what happened because of the creation of these volunteer opportunities. And the ability to see, again, the hands-on experience and the learning, I think, was one of the big takeaways.
Did they also talk about the impact that they saw in their communities when they did this?
Oh, definitely.
What was that like? What did they say about that?
They were able to make a difference because some of them were able to actually create new programs to help the homeless, to help those who were hungry, to help those who were new to their communities. And so they saw that, yes, they could have an impact, even through their student organizations. So again, when they go out into the work world after they graduate, they will then be able to take that experience and know that, yes, they can be effective, that they can have an impact and a positive impact on their communities.
By the way, are they looking at these students as a career, or is it partly an adjunct to maybe perhaps going to work for some profit business, but nonetheless being involved in nonprofit? I mean, what do you see there?
Most of the students that spoke with were interested in working for nonprofits of varying sizes. You know, as Carolina said, you've got the huge nonprofits like the Red Cross and the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts and other organizations like that. But then you've got the local nonprofits, the smaller groups. And so these students are earning a certificate in nonprofit leadership. And they will then be able to work in these nonprofits. Now, of course, some of them may work in a nonprofit for a short period and then go on and do something else. I mean, as we know, people these days don't stay in a job for very long and may move from one job to another. But they can then work for a nonprofit, work somewhere else, go back and work for a nonprofit. But I think kind of the main idea for these students is that no matter what they do, they want to have a positive impact on their communities and the world around them.
I was going to ask you that. I mean, do you think this is typical of this generation? I mean, you see a lot of kids, you see a lot of students coming through SU. I'm assuming, obviously, a lot of them are going to go to work for profit organizations, as the case may be. But do you gather a sense that there's more than that for them in terms of making a living, but rather giving back in some fashion?
I do. More and more I'm seeing that in the students who that we deal with, that we work with. More and more of them, no matter what they do, want to be able to make their communities and the world around them a better place. Mm-hmm. And so even if they're working for a profit-making institution, they want to be able to have some sort of impact. If they don't do it through their job, then they will do it as a volunteer.
The other thing, too, I mean, we talk a lot about nonprofits and as we talk about a lot of institutions. Do you think it gives them a better understanding of what nonprofits are doing as opposed to maybe some people who never entered them at all?
Oh, definitely. The students in this certificate program will learn that there are a lot of myths about nonprofits. And the myths that, for one thing, that nonprofits can't make money. Yes, they can, but it has to be directed toward the continuing work of the nonprofit. And also the myth that nonprofits are just sort of kind of pulled together and they're the work of, a group of just good-hearted people who don't have any business sense. Well, that's not true at all. if you're going to be successful and if you're going to have an impact, you have to know what you're doing. And so these students are seeing that. And it's not just the classroom experiences, it's the hands-on experiences that they have with their internships, working in local nonprofits, or working for international nonprofits, or doing study abroad experiences where they can work with groups and organizations that are around our world. And so they get that hands-on experience too.
By the way, do you see a distinction, or do students see a distinction between nonprofits, say, like, for instance, the Red Cross, for example, as opposed to advocacy groups, nonprofits? I mean, I've ran into a lot of them when I was in Washington, D.C., where it's that, yes, you're a nonprofit, but you are arguing for a particular, sometimes, piece of legislation or a particular idea, as opposed to the, I'm going to help out the homeless in this particular community.
I think that's... one of the myths that a lot of people hold about nonprofits is that they can't become involved in the political process. And yes, there are a lot of regulations surrounding the involvement of nonprofits in the political process. However, it doesn't mean that you can't advocate, become an advocate for a particular group of people or for a particular piece of legislation. It just means that you can't become involved in our political process, say, advocating for one party or another.
Right. Yeah, because when I was in Washington, I saw a number of nonprofits who advocated for certain positions and amazingly often won despite lots of money from, say, corporate interests. I mean, is that something that these students realize that they may be the David versus the Goliath, but nonetheless they can win?
It may be. Yeah. And I think at least they're learning that is something they can be involved in. And so if you have someone who is majoring in political science and wants to become involved in the advocacy process, they can become involved in the certificate program and then enter the nonprofit world as an advocate for a particular group of people. And in that way, make their community a better place.
So Ben,
yes.
How did you decide that you were going to get involved with this?
Well, I guess it kind of started 3 years ago when I got involved with Students Helping Honduras on the campus of the University of Maryland. And so that's a nonprofit primarily concerned with international development, namely in education. And so our big mission is to basically go down to Honduras and build schools. And so when we come back, we fundraise all that money to try and then build the schools. So I came back to Salisbury for my sophomore year, and I quickly got involved in SHH here on the Salisbury campus, and then, you know, one thing led to another, and I became the president. And so my dad, Martin Paraboom, hi, Dad, if you're listening, he suggested that I reach out to Dr. Bound because we have this nonprofit leadership alliance program for me on campus, and I could take a course, I could go down to a conference, and this year it was in Orlando. So I took the nonprofit course with Dr. Bound, which was a very enlightening experience. It blew me away at how many different capacities nonprofits operate in. So you go to a few workshops in the afternoon, you know, learn about how to run a board of directors, you know, you kind of pick and choose which ones you're going to go to, how nonprofits lobby in Washington, how all these things happen. So you kind of have to pick and choose because there's a lot of workshops going on at once. But at night, you watch The Florida Project. This film is set in Central Florida, and it's about these families that basically live in these motels that were kind of once, you know, in their heyday, they were where families went to stay when, you know, they were going to Disney World or something like that. And this is such, it was such a painful film to watch, but it's something that encapsulated the problems that Central Florida deals with so well. It shows the pain of living in poverty the way these people are, but it never succumbs to it because you have these children that are making lives for themselves. So that was just to start the conference off with a screening like that. It really, it kind of I was like, I didn't really know what to expect. Like, it made me really excited to wake up the next morning and see what we were going to talk about. But then we woke up the next morning, and we had policy experts, or kind of people who worked in the field, in the fields of transportation, housing, and food. And these are kind of the big, especially transportation, are the problems that plague Central Florida and the Orlando area, kind of the Tri-County area. So we kind of got to see, like, on the ground, from watching the Florida Project, you kind of see this, you know, artistic interpretation of what Central Florida struggles with. And then you have these policy experts. So you have a guy who is on the transportation committee for this Tri-County area. And then you have somebody who works in a nonprofit that helps to get food to these communities. And then you have somebody who works in housing. And so basically what they would do is they would explain kind of what the problems are, have these really, really well thought out presentations. And then you would get in a group of students from basically all over the country. You'll have people representing the private sector, you'll have people representing the public sector, and you'll have people representing the nonprofit sector. And that was really interesting because you kind of see how everything works together.
In terms of the choice that you may be making, that is to go into nonprofit as opposed to, say, a profit company, what makes you want to, say, maybe slide into the nonprofit? What kind of distinction are you making that for your own personal life?
I think for profit, your mission is not ultimately serving others in some cases. Like, you can have side projects that do that. And I'm not saying for-profit organizations don't have a lot of really, really good initiatives happening. But I think just nonprofits are the way to most directly address these issues. So when I'm going down and doing work for Students Helping Honduras, you know, I'll go down and work on a school and I'm coming back and fundraising. And that's kind of our reason for existence. That's always been my belief, that that's the most direct and effective way to help people, or just be part of that process to put people in a position to be successful. And I have always believed in, you know, doing development sustainably and doing it the right way. It basically means, like, it means that all of my resources and all of my brain power are going to this mission that I want to accomplish.
So what was it like working in Honduras? I mean, we've all heard about it's a tough, the triangles that were, and we see a lot of, I've talked to a number of undocumented immigrants are coming out of that particular area that it sounds tough. What was it like working down there, and what were the people like? What was that experience like for you?
Oh, wow, that's a good question again. You hear about people going on, you know, service trips, like, oh, it changed my life and everything, but really it just, it made me so, how do I put this into words? It was, you know, the people I meet down there, the strength and the agency I see in these people that have a real desire to make their communities better and to, you know, improve the situation for their children, to basically build a better future for themselves. I'm just happy to be a part of that process. I really, really am. I've heard the stories of the some of the Masons we work alongside, and the Shin, the founder and CEO. Mm-hmm. I've heard his stories and the things you hear, to the things that, you know, some of the people down there I've met have been through. Like, it's really, I have no frame of reference for understanding that, but to know that, you know, when I see these children that, you know, I may see once or twice a year, it's still such an empowering feeling to just know that, like, I'm involved in this experience. And I never want to say, you know, I'm going down there and I'm, you know, I'm saving the world, because so many nonprofits and have a reputation for saying things like that. But really, I just want to be a sidekick. So, you know, I'm going to come back. I'm going to fundraise my butt off, and just, I want to be a part of that process. You know, I just want to, I just want to make the world a little bit better. I guess the analogy is, you know, there's the kid throwing starfish back in the ocean that are washed up on the beach, and a guy's like, you know, why are you throwing starfish back? There's like 10,000 more. You're never going to save them all. But, you know, to just have, you know, my stamp on, you know, four schools before I graduate would just be really nice, because, you know, that's like 500 kids that are going to school. And so it's really, obviously the people you meet are wonderful. They're friendly. They're hardworking. It's great. And obviously my Spanish is absolutely, it isn't what it could be, but, you know, I try, and there's a lot of goodwill between all of us. I know when to pass a cement block, because they'll say block A, and I'm like, okay, that's a block. So, and obviously, you know, you play soccer, you get really, really involved with the community. You know, the kids will love it when you just, like, pick them up and throw them for some reason. I don't know. That's just really interesting. And they always want to, you know, a piggyback ride and stuff. So it's always fun to, you know, play soccer with the community and just kind of be involved. And so, like, that is definitely something I'd like to make my career for at least a few years after college. You know, maybe sign a couple year contract to do media production work for them. That's kind of the dream right now. But yeah, it's been probably one of the best things I've found in college, and I mean that with all my heart.
Was there anything that surprised you when you were down there?
I didn't really have any expectations going in because I know how we can misrepresent mm-hmm. places like Honduras and these developing right. countries, and we can see these kids with no shoes on and dirty faces, but maybe that's just because he was playing in the mud and he didn't want to wear shoes. So I really had no expectations going in, but you know, when you step off that school bus and just, you know, you have all these little children coming up to greet you, and it's really, you know, it's a fulfilling feeling. That's not really why I do it, though. I think, you know, to exist is just to coexist. So, you know, to just meet so many interesting people and learn about such an interesting and rich culture, that's kind of been the most rewarding thing for me.
So if a student wants to get involved with this, how do they do it?
Well, it's pretty easy. The student just enroll in the foundational course. And they can take it online, or they can take it hybrid once a week, as Ben was saying, that he had a great time once a week meeting with other people who are interested. And then they just have to complete certain requirements. It's not big. It's not a major. It's not a minor. And they have to attend a conference. They have to show leadership. Many students already do things in their communities or at the university, and they haven't considered them important. And so we look at that. There is a checklist. And then finally, there is an internship. And that's super important because we want students to have an experience with work. It's a real work experience. While they are in college, they have a mentor, and in that internship, they learn and apply all the things they've been learning in the course or in any other of the experiences or at the AMI conference. So it's easy. It will take maybe a year, but doesn't mean that it will take one more year of school, because it's only really one course and an internship that they can apply to their major as well, or use it with AmeriCorps and get a stipend, or go to the Washington Center in D.C. So there are many ways of addressing all the requirements.
We've been speaking with Carolina Baum, the Salisbury University Campus Director for the Nonprofit Leadership Alliance, Catherine Jackson, SU's Program Specialist for Interdisciplinary Studies, and Ben Paraboom, who is a student at SU and has been involved with the program. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.